Welcome to this deep dive into the source material. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are tackling a truly monumental stack of content.
Monumental is the right word. I'm Sam Astor, and we are going straight into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, November 28th, 2025.
Exactly. Our goal here for you, the well-informed learner, is to provide a thorough, comprehensive, and a detailed report on every single major article.
We're aiming for what consultants call a MEAC analysis, right?
Right. Mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive. We want to cover everything with no overlap.
And really give you the context and the critical so what for all of these massive stories.
It's an urgent read. I mean, it fundamentally questions the assumptions of the last 30 years.
It really does.
We begin with a jarring, deeply unsettling shift in global security. We're moving from decades of post-Cold War stability.
That whole peace dividend idea.
Right into the fastest military buildup since World War II.
Yeah.
And it's centered right in the economic heart of Europe.
Okay, so let's unpack this. The detail the journal provided on Germany dusting off its preparations for war is incredible.
It's the kind of source material that, you know, should be keeping leaders awake at night.
Absolutely. We are talking about Operation Plan Germany, or O-Plan.
And this thing is... what, 1,200 pages?
1,200 pages, classified, drafted over 2.5 painstaking years by dozens of senior German and NATO officers. It's detailing minute preparations for a potential large-scale war with Russia.
And the mission detail in O-Plan is just staggering. It completely redefines Germany's strategic role.
It does. They are shifting from being a, you know, a relatively safe frontline state to becoming NATO's central logistical hub. The staging ground.
The plan outlines how up to 800,000 German, U.S., and other NATO troops will be mobilized and moved east toward the front line.
And that volume of movement in that short time frame.
It requires infrastructure that, frankly, is currently failing. Mm.
It absolutely is.
Right.
O-Plan is less a war strategy and more a comprehensive audit of failure. It exposes these critical vulnerabilities that are a direct result of that peace dividend logic from the 90s and 2000s.
The sources highlight that 20% of German federal highways and over a quarter of their highway bridges need urgent major repairs.
Man, when you're planning to move heavy armor, hundreds of thousands of troops, and endless supply convoys.
Those crumbling bridges become mission-critical choke points.
Exactly. But it's more insidious than just general neglect, though.
Right. The sources point out that specific strategic Cold War infrastructure wasn't just neglected, it was actively undermined.
You think about the A-44 highway. It has sections designed to serve as emergency landing strips for aircraft.
Solid tarmac medians, quick dismantled guardrails, that was the dual-use mindset of the Cold War.
But decades later, new civilian tunnels and bridges were built that are now too narrow, too low, or just too flimsy for modern military convoys and heavy equipment.
They literally unlearned how to build resilience into their national infrastructure.
Because they believed they'd never need it again. It's peacetime bureaucracy undoing wartime preparation.
And this complexity, it extends to their entire logistical chain, including their seaports.
The North Sea and Baltic Sea harbors require an estimated 15 billion euros in overall repairs.
With 3 billion of that specifically for dual-use upgrades, reinforcing docks, railway lines.
All the things you need if Germany is going to be the logistics center, those harbors are the lifeline for all NATO reinforcements flowing in from the U.S. and U.K.
So if they fail, the entire NATO response just stalls out.
And the goal isn't just a military fix. It's an all-of-society approach.
Integrating the military with the private sector, police, hospitals, civil defense agencies.
It's a return to total defense planning.
Yeah.
You know, but updated for modern hybrid threats like mass drone use and cyber warfare.
Which means integrating data protection laws with military rapid response planning.
A nightmare in a highly bureaucratic state like Germany.
And we got a really painful illustration of this in the Red Storm Bravo exercise they ran in Hamburg.
Oh, this part. The scenario was a rapid response drill. 500 NATO troops land, form a 65-vehicle convoy, and move east.
And the execution was a comedy of errors. It just highlights this systemic rot.
First, the convoy itself was poorly coordinated. Huge, dangerous gaps between vehicles.
Then a drone buzzed the convoy, causing panic and confusion on the ground.
Right, before it was eventually and very belatedly confirmed to be one of their own drones.
That lack of drone recognition capability is a massive vulnerability right there.
But the single most telling anecdote, the thing that just perfectly captures the peacetime bureaucratic habits.
The protesters.
The mock reservist protesters, part of the drill, glued themselves to the tarmac to simulate civil disruption.
And here's the kicker. The civilian police force, which was tasked with handling them, lacked the necessary solvents.
That's right. A two-hour delay for a 65-vehicle convoy trying to move 6 miles.
All because of a lack of simple, off-the-shelf solvents.
The absurdity is profound. It's a powerful metaphor for how decades of non-military habits are now throttling the urgent need for military cohesion. The state is just not optimized for speed.
And beyond that institutional sclerosis, the risk of active sabotage in Germany as NATO's hub is massive.
Well, yeah. The sources note a recent Munich court case where a Russian agent was jailed for planning to sabotage German railways.
We also saw reports this week from Poland about Russian involvement in damaging tracks there.
Attacking Germany isn't a secondary objective. It's the primary enemy target to choke off NATO's response.
Precisely. The goal of OPLAN isn't just to be ready to fight. It's to deter the conflict by demonstrating resilience.
And German officials, they expect Russia to be ready to attack NATO by 2029. That's a hard timeline.
But analysts are warning that an armistice in Ukraine, which we'll get into next, could accelerate that timeline.
It could free up resources for Moscow to pivot against NATO members much, much sooner. The clock is ticking far faster than the police can find the right solvent.
Which brings us directly to the diplomatic chaos that's happening in parallel. It is deeply unsettling Europe's political leaders.
This juxtaposition is the core of the dilemma for Europe.
On one hand, they're frantically preparing for war.
And on the other, the U.S. president's envoys are drafting peace plans that many European capitals see as a reward for Russian aggression.
The sources detail a highly contentious 28-point U.S. peace proposal for Ukraine.
Allegedly crafted by Trump envoys, including Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, with input from high-level Russian figures like Kirill Dmitriev.
And the consensus in Europe is that this plan is highly friendly to Russia.
And you can see why. I mean, you look at the provisions.
It includes mandates to cap Ukraine's military size, permanently bar Ukraine from ever entering NATO.
And most explosively, hand Russia uncaptured land in Ukraine's east.
Territory that Russia failed to seize in nearly 4 years of brutal fighting. For European allies, that sends a dangerous signal.
The signal is that aggression will ultimately be rewarded at the negotiating table.
And when Vladimir Putin commented on the plan, he was highly strategic about it.
He called it a good starting point and confirmed it took Russia's perspective into account, but then qualified it as a list of questions requiring work.
He also raised that political obstacle, dismissing Ukrainian President Zelensky's legitimacy because Zelensky can't hold new elections while the country is under martial law.
And the whole situation just exploded into public view thanks to a leak of a phone call.
Between the envoy Witkoff and Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, the mystery of who leaked it and why is a critical geopolitical game of, well, clue.
There are three main suspects, and each theory is fascinating.
First, European intelligence services hoping to sabotage a Russia-friendly plan that they felt undermined their security.
Second, Russian elements or oligarchs who are actually profiting from the war and want the conflict to continue. Peace is bad for business.
And the third theory is maybe the most concerning, a rogue member of a U.S. government agency.
Worried that the administration would press Ukraine into a deal that fundamentally compromises U.S. security interests and unduly favors Russia.
The leak itself revealed Witkoff coaching Ushakov on how to handle President Trump.
Right, suggesting Putin should start the conversation by lavishing praise on Trump for the Gaza ceasefire plan.
It just highlights Trump's preference for informal brokers and personality-driven deals over established diplomatic channels.
And that lack of adherence to procedure is exactly what U.S. adversaries, Russia and China, are playing to.
They see his eagerness to strike deals as a chance to undermine U.S. leadership and alliance stability.
So European governments, seeing these back-channel talks that diverge so sharply from NATO policy, are increasingly worried that U.S. interests are moving away from theirs. It creates a deep fundamental mistrust.
And that mistrust is being leveraged globally. As the sources connect the dots, Russia is using this moment.
And China is simultaneously trying to steer Trump toward potentially sacrificing Taiwan's status in exchange for a critical U.S.-China trade accord.
Which brings us perfectly to Asia. The pressure on U.S. alliances is clearly not just in Europe. It's a recurring theme everywhere, especially when Taiwan is involved.
Absolutely. The geopolitical pressure points are completely interlinked. China is aggressively testing the limits of the U.S. alliance structure in Asia, just as Russia is in Europe.
This friction was recently ignited by Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi.
She suggested that a Chinese attack on Taiwan would naturally pull Japan into a conflict alongside the U.S.
A comment that understandably infuriated China's Xi Jinping.
Beijing retaliated with economic and diplomatic measures. The rhetoric was extreme. One Chinese diplomat even publicly suggested her neck should be cut off.
And she spent a full half hour of a phone call with Trump hammering home China's historic claim to Taiwan.
So Trump's reaction to his Japanese ally, Takaichi, was telling and immediate. After that call with Xi, he advised her to lower volume on Taiwan.
The message that Japanese officials took away was deeply concerning. The president did not want friction over Taiwan to endanger a trade detente he reached last month with Xi.
A detente that includes promises for massive purchases of U.S. agricultural products.
Trump's comment that the U.S. relationship with China is very good and that anything good for American farmers is good for him.
It signaled a clear prioritization of short-term economic gains over long-term strategic alliance cohesion.
And what's critical here is how this decision explicitly links the U.S.-China trade truce and Taiwan's long-term security in the minds of Asian allies.
It raises severe questions about the depth of the U.S. commitment. When the U.S. leader appears to prioritize soybean purchases over backing a key ally's strong defense stance,
the alliance structure inevitably frays, and allies begin to hedge their bets.
Speaking of Taiwan, its strategic importance really revolves around one thing.
Semiconductors. And the sources highlight a high-stakes investigation into trade secrets that puts two giants, Intel and TSMC, in the middle of a geopolitical showdown.
This is the case of Weijian Lo, a highly accomplished Taiwanese engineer known for breakthroughs in chip manufacturing.
And Lo recently left TSMC, the world's most critical chip maker, to join Intel.
Which is, notably, now 10% U.S. government-owned, thanks to massive domestic subsidies.
The stakes are immense. The U.S. government is pouring billions into Intel to revitalize domestic chip production and reduce global dependency on Taiwan.
So Taiwanese authorities acted swiftly. They raided Lo's residences, seized evidence, including a computer.
And they're investigating whether he improperly transferred national security-related technology. His assets have been frozen.
TSMC is suing him, alleging violation of non-compete and confidentiality agreements.
And what makes their case particularly potent is the allegation that Lo told company lawyers he was planning to move into academia,
specifically to avoid triggering scrutiny. Yet, right up until his departure, he was still asking engineers for briefings on the company's most closely guarded research.
The next generation manufacturing plans known internally as the Nighthawk Project.
Intel denies the allegations, of course. They say they have no reason to believe there is any merit to the claims.
But Taiwan's sensitivity is completely understandable, given the history of trade secret leakage. We saw this before with Liang Meng-song.
Right, the R&D executive who moved first to Samsung and then to China's CXL Semina. After which, both companies made rapid technological leaps, closing the gap with TSMC.
So this case is a perfect crystallization of the high-tech arms race. Washington is pushing Intel to reestablish a trusted U.S. chip-making business.
But Intel still relies on TSMC for its most advanced components. Hiring someone like Lo is part of a desperate effort to revitalize their engineering culture.
But Taiwan's criminal investigation shows the island is determined to protect its technological crown jewels. They see any leakage as a direct national security threat.
From the cutting edge of high-tech secrets, we shift abruptly to the centuries-old channels of illicit finance.
Specifically, how Iranian funds are flowing to Hezbollah through the global financial hub of Dubai.
This story exposes a critical financial lifeline for a U.S.-sanctioned terrorist organization. Iran is funneling hundreds of millions of dollars to Hezbollah via money exchanges and businesses based in Dubai.
Dubai has historically been Tehran's key hub for laundering funds and evading international sanctions.
And Hezbollah is in desperate need of cash. They're trying to rebuild and rearm after a bruising conflict with Israel.
Their previous smuggling routes through Syria were disrupted, and Lebanese authorities have tightened controls at the Beirut airport, making it much harder to move bulk cash.
This forced Iran and Hezbollah to rely more heavily on Dubai and the ancient hawala method.
For listeners who might not be familiar, hawala is a traditional, informal value transfer system.
It's based entirely on trust, not physical transfer. Funds are deposited with a dealer in Dubai, who then tells a counterpart in Lebanon to pay out the equivalent amount to Hezbollah.
And it's highly effective because it operates completely outside the conventional, traceable banking system.
To avoid the tighter airport security, Iran's Quds force has adapted its tactics. They're sending larger numbers of travelers, each carrying smaller amounts of cash or high-value items like jewelry.
The sources estimate that Iran has transferred over $1 billion to Hezbollah since January, primarily through these money exchange companies in Dubai.
The U.S. is deeply concerned about this. They're demanding that Lebanon shut down Al-Qard Al-Hassan,
which is a key Hezbollah-affiliated bank structured as a charity that operates outside the purview of Lebanon's central bank.
And the context for the UAE here is important. They were previously on the FATF gray list. That's the Financial Action Task Force.
The global anti-money laundering watchdog.
Right. And though they were removed 2 years ago, this revelation underscores how vulnerable global financial hubs like Dubai remain to illicit flows supporting sanctioned actors like Hezbollah.
It creates a fascinating contrast, the speed of the chips trade secret scandal versus this ancient trust-based financial system used by terrorists.
Both are key components of global instability right now.
That's a powerful point. We move now from international conflict and illicit finance to the volatile domestic political and legal scene in the U.S. We start with the stunning collapse of the Georgia election interference case.
Indeed. This is maybe the most politically consequential legal development of the week. A Georgia judge formally dropped the high-profile IRA-UA election interference case against the former president and his inner circle,
including Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows. This effectively ends a long, contentious legal battle.
That began with a massive, voluminous indictment over 2 years ago.
Just to clarify, IRA-UA is the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It was originally designed to take down the mafia.
And it's powerful because it lets prosecutors charge everyone in a conspiracy, from the leader to the low-level operative, with the same maximum penalty. It's high risk, high reward.
But the new prosecutor, Peter Scandalakis, moved to dismiss the 41-count indictment. And his justification is what's so significant.
His primary justification was extremely practical and political. He said there is no realistic prospect of compelling a sitting president to stand trial before his term expires in January 2029.
By which time, the core events will have happened 8 years prior.
It's a major structural admission. It suggests that, regardless of the merits of the case, the timing made it impossible to prosecute effectively. It's essentially a constitutional and temporal shield.
The second point he emphasized strikes at the heart of the conspiracy claim. Questioning election results is not illegal.
Right. He suggested that the former president's attempts to overturn his loss could be interpreted as him genuinely believing fraud had occurred,
which severely weakens the element of criminal intent needed for a RIDO conviction.
And of course, this collapse happened after the case was already severely damaged.
The original prosecutor, Finney Willis, was removed from the case due to allegations of a romantic and financially beneficial relationship with her lead prosecutor, Nathan Wade.
Her public conduct during those hearings created a massive, damaging public spectacle, diverting attention from the merits of the case and giving the former president significant political ammunition.
So moving from that story of high-profile legal failure to one of accountability success, we turn to the incredible saga of the Hunter Biden whistleblowers.
This is a story of sheer perseverance against the institutional weight of the U.S. government.
IRS agents Gary Shapley and Joseph Siegler blew the whistle on the initial, allegedly politicized DOJ investigation into Hunter Biden.
They used whistleblower laws. They went through Congress. They spoke to the media to expose misconduct. They just refused to quit when they felt the investigation was being suppressed.
And their actions resulted in several significant layered wins. First, forcing the exposure of the Biden family's business dealings in unprecedented detail,
which eventually led to Hunter's felony tax and gun conviction. And while the pardon removed the immediate threat of jail time,
the sources explicitly call that pardon a permanent stain on the administration. It confirms the whistleblowers forced the truth onto the public record.
But maybe the most profound and lasting win came from their lawsuits against the IRS and DOJ for illegal retaliation.
They won significant financial settlements. But crucially, the DOJ settlement includes a mandate for comprehensive training for federal prosecutors.
And this training will specifically address the fact that leaning on investigators from other agencies or suppressing their findings is an actionable, punishable offense.
That training mandate sets a major precedent. It creates a powerful new guardrail against government agencies leaning on or intimidating investigators from other branches.
Exactly. A form of institutional check and balance that was informal, but is now legally required.
And the final victory came quietly. Hunter Biden, who had sued the whistleblowers claiming they violated his tax privacy, dropped his lawsuit.
His lawyer also settled a defamation case brought by the agents. It was a decisive and structural win for accountability.
Now we shift to a truly distressing story about the release of sensitive information related to the Jeffrey Epstein case. Here we see transparency and protection collide.
Congress had mandated the Justice Department release documents tied to Epstein, hoping to provide clarity.
But when the files were made public by the House Oversight Committee, dozens of victims' names, including individuals who were minor children at the time, were left unredacted.
The lawyers for the victims, Bradley Edwards and Brittany Henderson, immediately asked federal judges to intervene. They argued the failure to redact might be intentional.
They also noted a terrifying possibility that the DOJ may be working from an incomplete list of victims, potentially missing adult women trafficked after 2008.
And this failure immediately became a nasty political football.
The sources describe conflict where Democrats released heavily redacted emails and Republicans subsequently released the same email unredacted, exposing Virginia Giuffre's name.
Both sides accused the other of selective leaking for political purposes, either to smear political figures or to score points on transparency while neglecting the duty to protect victims.
The lawyers for the victims emphasized the horrific consequence. These women are not political pawns. They are mothers, wives, and daughters.
It just raises serious questions about the government's competence and ethics in handling highly sensitive information.
Finally, in our political section, we have the tragic ambush on the National Guard in D.C. that has triggered immediate, wide-reaching policy implications.
This tragedy involves U.S. Army's Sarah Beckstrom, just 20 years old, who died after being shot. U.S. Air Force Staff Ashenit Andrew Wolf remains in critical condition.
The shooter was identified as Ramanullah Lakhanwal, a 29-year-old Afghan national and asylum recipient who previously worked with a CIA-backed military unit.
The political reaction was immediate and fierce. The president called the suspect a savage monster and linked the attack directly to the prior administration's botched U.S. withdrawal and the subsequent failure of the vetting process.
The suspect had received temporary immigration status for assisting the U.S. government and was granted asylum just this past April.
And the policy fallout was stark and immediate. The Department of Homeland Security immediately halted all immigration requests for Afghan nationals indefinitely, pending a review.
They also launched reviews of all asylum cases approved under the prior administration and all green cards issued from a list of countries of concern.
But the long-term implication, highlighted in an opinion piece, is equally severe. While the motive is unknown, abandoning allies who assist Americans in war
sends a terrifying message globally. That lack of faith or perceived collective punishment of all Afghans in the U.S. could deter future necessary assistance for American troops overseas.
It's an agonizing paradox. How do you respond decisively to an act of terror committed by someone you helped, while also ensuring you don't betray the thousands of others who risk their lives based on the promise of American support?
That concludes our look at the geopolitical and legal turmoil. We now shift gears completely to the economic decisions shaping American households and global markets.
We start with the latest updates on the labor market and those stubborn inflation figures.
The latest data points us toward a labor market the Fed would call neutral, not expanding, not contracting.
Initial jobless claims fell slightly to 216,000, which is good. But the number of continuing claims people filing for unemployment week after week is gradually rising to 1.96 million, near a four-year high.
That statistic is crucial. It suggests that while layoffs are subdued, hiring is absolutely flagging. It's significantly harder for people who have lost work to find new roles.
And the unemployment rate also ticked up to 4.4%, the highest since late 2021. This indicates labor market slack is finally catching up.
But as the labor market sputters, the Federal Reserve's Beige Book, that anecdotal compilation of economic activity, found that cost and price pressures stubbornly persist. Inflation is still elevated.
So what's driving that sticky inflation? According to the anecdotal reports, manufacturers and retailers blame tariffs, the cost of which they are passing directly to consumers.
Also, many companies across multiple industries said the rising cost of providing health care for workers is significantly straining their budgets, forcing them to raise prices.
The Beige Book provided some excellent specific anecdotes about consumer behavior. Wealthier Americans are still driving sales at the high end, but general consumers are definitely pulling back.
Car dealers noted a measurable drop in electric vehicle sales after federal tax subsidies expired, a direct example of how demand-side stimulus affects sales.
And the most culturally relevant anecdote. A business told the Kansas City Fed that top tattoo artists, who are usually booked solid for months, suddenly have open slots.
That is a truly granular signal of tightening discretionary spending.
We also saw the localized ripple effect of the recent government shutdown. The pullback in spending by government employees led directly to a drop in sales at Pennsylvania auto dealers, among others.
And AI is already transforming the labor picture. We see booming investment in AI-related infrastructure, which is great for some sectors.
But companies are pulling back on entry-level hiring, using AI to automate basic tasks instead. One contact reported that fewer students want to study data science because they're worried AI will replace those jobs.
This uncertain environment, slowing labor market, sticky inflation, is leading directly to a split in the Federal Reserve.
The sources indicate the Fed is divided between officials wanting a third straight quarter-point rate cut and those wanting to hold rates steady to fight inflation.
Markets, however, are betting heavily on a cut, currently putting an 85% probability on it.
Shifting focus, let's look at a key battle in U.S. social policy, the fight over extending the ACA subsidies.
This is set to cause financial pain for millions if they expire.
Centrist Democrat Senator Jeanne Shaheen is pushing hard for a bipartisan compromise to extend the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies, which benefit over 20 million Americans.
The political challenge lies in the ideological sticking points. Republicans view the subsidies as expensive and want to tighten eligibility.
They want an income cap, maybe around $200,000, and requiring people to pay at least something toward their premiums to prevent fraud.
Democrats fear these measures would deter enrollment. But the political pressure on Republicans is intense, especially in red states.
If the subsidies expire, premiums are set to increase sharply, the premium cliff. And those lawmakers are eager to find an extension to fend off voter anger.
This debate connects directly to a broader, highly critical opinion piece in the Journal about the peril of demand-side economics.
The core argument is highly provocative. Washington loves to help buyers with subsidies, but fundamentally ignores producers and supply constraints.
This creates a vicious cycle where subsidies drive up demand, which spikes prices, necessitating more subsidies.
The ACA is the canonical example. The law dramatically increased demand for healthcare services.
But did almost nothing to increase the supply of doctors, nurses, or facilities. Healthcare employment growth remained flat, about 2% annually, before and after the ACA.
And the result is predictable. According to data cited, average family premiums increased by a stunning 96% from 2010 to 2025.
From about $13,000 to nearly $27,000.
And the same flawed strategy is now being applied to housing. The current administration is proposing demand-side fixes like 50-year mortgages and portable mortgages.
But the fundamental problem in housing is a massive systemic shortage of units. The sources estimate a shortage of nearly 5 million units in 2023.
Longer-term mortgages do nothing to build a single new home. They simply fuel demand with cheap credit, leading to higher prices.
The solution, according to this analysis, must pivot to expanding supply, zoning reform, faster permitting, and for healthcare, reforming licensing laws to increase the number of practitioners.
The simple point is that government fueling demand, divorced from supply, will always raise costs.
That underlying structural tension is defining so much of the U.S. economy. And on the corporate side, we're seeing signs that regulation is relaxing in other areas.
That's a perfect bridge. We move now to the high-stakes world of corporate decisions, finance, and regulatory friction, starting with the massive surge in U.S. mergers and acquisitions.
Corporate tie-ups are surging under the current administration, driven by what bankers describe as a significantly more relaxed approach to enforcement.
Deal value this year is up more than 40% to about $1.9 trillion. And crucially, there have been roughly twice as many deals valued over $10 billion than last year.
The deals are not only more frequent, but significantly larger. And the enforcement data supports this.
The Justice Department and FTC have sued to block only three mergers since Republican leaders took over. That's compared to an average of six per year under the prior administration.
We have some colossal examples. The $71.5 billion deal for Union Pacific to buy Norfolk Southern.
Creating the country's first coast-to-coast rail operator. And Nexstar Media Group's bid to buy Tegna would create a company reaching 60% of U.S. TV homes.
That requires the FCC to waive a rule that currently limits reach to 39%. These are unprecedented consolidations.
Interestingly, the sources mention that some dealmakers see paths to lobby the White House directly for approval, even when regulators are reluctant. The president likes deals and wants to see them get done.
To mitigate risk without costly trials, enforcers are heavily relying on settlements that require divestitures.
Meaning the merging companies must sell off pieces of a business to a competitor. The Justice Department sees this as a quicker, more effective remedy.
Next, we turn to a financial firm having a banner year, Cantor Fitzgerald, thanks to its risky bet on the crypto market.
Cantor Fitzgerald, the former firm of Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, is on track to book over $2.5 billion in revenue this year. That's nearly double its 2021 record.
Their winning strategy was an early, aggressive, and successful bet on cryptocurrencies, raising more than $40 billion in capital for the sector this year alone.
The firm's success is certainly boosted by an administration perceived as friendly to crypto, given the president's vow to make America the crypto capital of the world.
The influence of Howard Lutnick is palpable. A large painting of him hangs by the entry of Cantor's offices, and his two sons now run the firm.
They're prohibited from discussing firm business with their father, but the legacy and strategic ambition are clearly there.
But the success could be highly transitory, given the inherent volatility of the asset class.
Absolutely. The firm's massive bet comes amidst the industry's history of extreme booms and busts. That volatility was on full display recently when Bitcoin plunged below $81,000.
A $1 trillion loss across the broader crypto markets. This firm is succeeding by specializing in risk, and they must always manage the flip side of that.
That volatility is exactly why regulatory scrutiny remains a constant threat. And where regulation is relaxing for mergers, it came down hard in another area.
The SEC rejected the Dream Exchange's stock exchange license application.
The SEC rejected the application just 2 months after the Wall Street Journal reported on the startup's undisclosed financial ties to the Church of Scientology.
Dream Exchange had pitched itself with a powerful message as a NASDAQ for black-owned businesses, even naming itself after Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech.
But the SEC cited non-public information in press reports, raising questions about potential misuse of funds. Ultimately, they concluded this raised serious questions about the startup's capacity to fulfill its obligations.
The SEC stressed that exchanges are charged with a public trust to enforce securities laws and protect investors.
This rejection underscores that regulatory scrutiny remains extremely tight regarding the integrity of core financial infrastructure, especially when undisclosed conflicts arise.
Finally, on the corporate decision front, we must discuss JPMorgan Chase's massive commitment to London.
CEO Jamie Dimon is moving forward with plans to construct London's largest office block in Canary Wharf.
It will be a colossal 3 million square foot tower housing 12,000 people. This ends speculation about whether JPM would move its European operations to the more expensive city district.
Canary Wharf won out based on speed and cost. This new Norman Foster design tower reflects Diamond's ambition to extend JPM's lead as the world's most powerful financial institution.
And this commitment provides a huge shot in the arm for Canary Wharf, which has struggled with work-from-home trends pummeling commercial real estate.
Moving from the mega finance world, let's look at several stories concerning corporate culture, conduct, and technology.
We start with a major corporate culture failure at Campbell's.
They fired their IT vice president, Martin Bali, after leaked audio surfaced. In the recording, he allegedly made shockingly racist comments about Indian coworkers, calling them idiots.
And also disparaged the company's products as highly processed food meant only for poor people.
Campbell's responded immediately, firing him for cause. They were also forced to defend their product quality, issuing a fact sheet specifically stating Campbell's does not use 3D printed chicken.
Which highlights the tension between internal executive disdain and the base that actually buys the product.
Separately, we look at the culture crisis rocking Lloyd's of London, the world's oldest insurance marketplace.
This follows a reputational crisis concerning former CEO John Neal, who is accused of unfairly promoting an employee with whom he allegedly had an affair.
It highlights deep endemic cultural issues in the male-dominated clubby insurance industry. Lloyd's has struggled for years to stamp out sexism and racism.
The sources even note an attempt in 2014 to allow men to work in shirt sleeves on a hot day provoked an instant revolution.
They apologized in 2020 for historic links to slavery, But this new investigation underscores how resistant the core culture remains to modernization.
We also have a very modern corporate mishap, Citi's botched rollout of its new Strata Elite credit card.
The bank offered extra sign-up points for customers who apply through a special link provided in person at branches. But the link was leaked online,
attracting thousands of gamers and bad actors attempting to optimize rewards.
Citi ended up approving customers that otherwise would have flagged. They eventually froze all the accounts, demanding highly unusual income verification forms.
They admitted a glitch had triggered improper froze, but stressed that most of those affected knew they were circumventing the appropriate channels. A major headache.
The next friction point is AI, where the political battle over regulation is getting extremely chaotic, expensive, and divisive.
This is a fight fueled by billionaires and tech titans with massive financial war chests. Opponents of state-level regulation have already amassed over $100 million for their PACs.
The main faction opposing state regulation is Leading the Future, supported by heavyweights like Andreessen Horowitz and OpenAI co-founder Greg Brockman.
They argue a patchwork of state laws will slow America's progress in the AI arms race with China.
On the other side is Public First, which supports thoughtful regulation and aims to raise at least $50 million. They argue governments at all levels should have a hand in regulation.
The Brockmans themselves advocate for AI centrism, minimal burden on current technology, focus on innovation, and defending against misuse.
It's an unprecedented political fight, because the stakes are so comprehensive. National security, economic dominance, the very structure of the labor market.
From the future of technology, we pivot to a centuries-old criminal enterprise, the logistics of the drug trade on the high seas.
The focus here is on the go-fasts, sleek, highly powered fiberglass boats that serve as the primary workhorses for traffickers along the Colombian coastline.
These boats ferry narcotics worth as much as $70 million per run. Their operational motto is stark: deliver or die.
The new danger they face is immense. Since the U.S. designated traffickers as terrorists, they now face military strikes, which have tragically killed 83 people in over 20 attacks.
Yet the financial incentives are so gargantuan that the supply continues. A clean run of 2 or 3 tons can yield a pilot $100,000 for a single day's work.
The pilots and crews, often former fishermen, use complex strategies, running at night or in stormy weather, to outrun patrols. It's a ruthless logistical system driven by economic incentive.
Finally, we turn to a collection of essential world news and cultural snapshots that round out this comprehensive look at the world on Friday, November 28th, 2025.
On a humanitarian front, a massive blaze at Wang Fuk Court, a densely packed apartment complex in Hong Kong, tragically killed at least 94 people.
The deadliest fire since 1948, the speed of the fire spread has raised scrutiny of the flammable bamboo scaffolding used for renovation, a technique still common in Hong Kong.
We also see more evidence of Europe shifting to a war footing. French President Emmanuel Macron is resurrecting a voluntary 10-month military service program.
It starts small, aiming for 3,000 people, but the plan is to scale up to 50,000 participants by 2035, with the possibility of mandatory service in a major crisis.
On the financial side, we note that billionaire Todd Bolley, part owner of the Dodgers, has joined the race to acquire the international assets of Lukoil, the sanctions-hit Russian energy company, valued at $22 billion.
A significant departure for Bolley, known for sports and entertainment, into the highly volatile world of sanctioned energy assets.
In the arts, we pause to note the passing of acclaimed architect Robert A.M. Stern at age 86. A dominant figure in postmodern and contextual design.
His notable works include 15 Central Park West and the George W. Bush Presidential Center. He reshaped the skyline of major American cities.
And culturally, the sources share a wonderful local story, the saga of the manhole Michelangelo in Sioux City, Iowa.
Brandon Bradshaw, a general contractor, became a folk hero after he was arrested for painting bright neon-tinged sewer flowers on manhole covers, motivated, he said, by a desire to make people smile.
He was charged with criminal mischief, but the community rallied around him instantly. A friend started selling manhole Michelangelo t-shirts.
Ultimately, the local chamber of commerce brokered a deal to drop the charges. The sheer absurdity even inspired a nearby town to announce a manhole painting contest.
A great reminder of the power of whimsy and local rebellion.
On the entertainment side, Rian Johnson's third Benoit Blanc film, Wake Up Dead Man, is getting highly mixed reviews.
Criticized for a deeply convoluted plot and heavy-handed anti-rationalist monologues, reviewers noted the final 20-minute explanation was brutally complicated.
Conversely, The Baltimoreans, a charming romantic comedy, is praised for its realism and engaging performances, a more grounded slice of life.
So we've covered a dizzying array of content, from German war plans and international trade secret espionage to the collapse of major U.S. legal cases and the surge in corporate mergers.
If we synthesize this stack, the central tension that runs through every section is how decades of peacetime habits, bureaucratic, financial, political, are actively fighting the urgent needs of the present.
That's absolutely right. The German Oplane crisis isn't about failing to buy tanks. It's about the decades-long habit of infrastructural neglect and peacetime bureaucracy.
Like the solvent failure.
Crippling urgent readiness. Similarly, the demand-side economics piece argues that the habit of subsidizing buyers rather than addressing supply constraints actively creates crises in housing and healthcare.
Even the CityCard scandal was about customers trying to leverage the peacetime habit of rewards gaming.
The big picture is that global norms are eroding fast. Military stability in Europe is gone. Established diplomatic channels are bypassed by informal envoys.
And the presumed integrity of the domestic legal system has been compromised, as we saw with the Willis scandal.
The only thing that provides a counterbalance is institutional integrity, like the perseverance of the IRS whistleblowers who forced structural changes in the DOJ.
So let's leave you, the learner, with a final provocative thought to mull over that links these economic and technological trends.
We've seen that government intervention failed to fix supply in healthcare and housing because the fundamental resource scarcity wasn't addressed.
So, considering the exponential speed of AI development and the massive investments being poured into that infrastructure, what specific real-world resources beyond data science jobs or abstract data might become the next critical scarcity point?
Think about the physical structural things needed to sustain this AI boom power cooling rare earth minerals, and what happens when demand-side subsidies inevitably fail to fix that scarcity point.
That's a crucial question for the next decade of geopolitical and economic planning, something for you to ponder and explore on your own.
We'll catch you next time.